Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Tomorrow is primary election day in Pennsylvania, and among offices, Republicans and Democratic voters will be deciding are the U.S. Senate and U.S. House of Representatives. Even the primaries in this midterm election year are getting national attention because of the impact they could have on control of Congress, President Trump's agenda, and what voters think of Trump's first year and a half in office. Our guest today, during today's first segment, is on top of these issues and many others. Joining us is Robert Costa, moderator of Washington Week on PBS and national political reporter for The Washington Post. Mr. Costa, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Robert Costa, there's a lot to talk about. In fact, some very significant events and news related to foreign affairs over the last few days. But I wanted to start with electoral politics. As I mentioned, Pennsylvania's primary election scheduled for tomorrow. Most of the attention in Pennsylvania is on which Republican will emerge to face Democratic incumbent Tom Wolf this fall. But new congressional boundaries and energized Democrats have led many more candidates than a normal midterm. And there's other states across the country that may not have those new congressional districts. But I wondered, from your observations and your reporting, is there that same type of enthusiasm across the country?
There's enthusiasm in both parties that I've encountered throughout my reporting, going to different states. I actually went to cover Senator Casey early on a few months ago up in Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area. And he's really been one of, the most crucial senators to watch in 2018, a veteran senator, to be sure, a Democrat. But he's been able to navigate the Trump era as a red state Democrat in a way that others are trying to do around the country. And what I mean by that is he's embraced the traditional union-friendly Democratic position on trade. He's running as somewhat of a populist, old-school union Democrat. And that's really enabled him, along with his political savvy, just be in a pretty strong position against Congressman Lou Barletta, the likely Republican nominee who has been endorsed by President Trump. And it's a little more difficult on the state level because the gubernatorial race has elements of the nationalization that's infected and infused itself into many races around the country, and with Wagner and Mango really looking like they're going to be, one of them will face off against Governor Wolf. But that race isn't as nationalized in the same way as the Senate race.
One thing that's very noticeable about Senator Casey this year is he has been one of the most outspoken critics of the president and the Trump administration. And I won't say that the senator has been quiet in his time in Washington, but it is very noticeable that he has been a critic of the president.
He has, though it's interesting to pay attention to what he's critical of. He's critical often of the president's immigration policy, critical of the president's conduct. He talks about the Russia probe from time to time, but he's not critical so much of the economic policies or the trade policies. He did not vote for the tax cut bill, but he thinks in a way that there should be more done for the middle class. There should be more done on trade. And so you see Casey trying to balance that push for the suburban vote in places like where I grew up, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, in the southeast, and while also courting those Trump voters in his own northeast area and central Pennsylvania who went with President Trump. I mean, I still sticks out to me. The trip that really made me think President Trump was going to win the election in 2016 was when I took a drive across Pennsylvania from the western edge to the eastern edge to the Delaware River, and I just noticed there was this undercurrent of support for President Trump. And Casey saw that, I'm sure, as well, a couple years ago, and that's what he's trying to combat.
Well, where you're from, Bucks County is said to be an area that is undergoing some changes politically, not just Bucks County, but the whole suburban ring around the city of Philadelphia. That traditionally has been a moderate Republican area, but observations, polls seem to say that it is leaning more Democratic today. Did you notice that?
I did notice that, and you have someone like Brian Fitzpatrick, the brother of the former Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick, both moderate Republicans. Brian's in his first term, and that's usually the most vulnerable term for any House member I cover, is that first term, and especially if they're running in the first term in a swing year, a year that could be a midterm tough year for their own party. So Brian Fitzpatrick in Bucks County is considered one of the most vulnerable House Republicans in the country. Yet you see him really trying to distance himself from President Trump without really alienating President Trump. Again, it's a tricky dance for a lot of these people up in 2018, but Fitzpatrick's trying to do it. And he sees that a lot, Bucks County has a lot of people coming in from New Jersey and New York, more liberal. And he it's not just the moderate Republican bastion that it used to be. So he has to change and try to really survive the storm.
So I want to go back to what we were talking about earlier, about that enthusiasm across the country. As a veteran political reporter watching the entire country, not just Pennsylvania's primary, but there will be a whole host of primaries across the country. There were last week and for the next 3 weeks. What will you be watching for?
I'm really watching for enthusiasm. When you look at the resistance and the Women's March that were such big headlines in early 2017. We're now in May of 2018, more than a year later after that initial burst of energy on the left about President Trump. Where is that energy now? I'm wondering as a reporter, can it carry through some of these tough Democratic primaries into the November general election through the summer? You see a lot of difficult issues that are confronting the Democrats. They have a lot of opportunity because there is some dissatisfaction in many quarters with President Trump. You see his poll numbers solid among Republicans, but not so solid among swing voters and independents. But the Democrats, because they saw this potential blue wave, they have very crowded primaries in some of these states, and they have to have their own civil war of sorts. Republicans have been in, just objectively speaking, a civil war in their own way for about a decade, ever since George W. Bush left office. Who's going to control the Republican Party? Is it going to be the base, the Breitbart, the Trump wing? Is it going to be the moderate Republicans, Ohio Governor John Kasich? Democrats, because they're not as dramatic in their sparring as Republicans, they're not getting as much attention. But you look at a lot of these Democratic primaries across the country. There's another one in Georgia, their gubernatorial race this month, where they're really dealing with progressive tensions versus liberal tensions. And then you have the moderate Democrats trying to see they can be the future as well. And you think about the 2020 Democratic presidential race on the horizon, that really captures how the Democrats haven't figured out exactly where they want to go.
You know, right after President Trump took office, and there was so much controversy, and a lot of people say so much chaos, that many people looked at it as almost a foregone conclusion that there would be a blue wave. Now, and by that I mean that Democrats would win big in these midterm elections. Since then, and that's not saying that won't happen, but since then, there have been some things that have happened that have energized Republicans. You touched on this a little bit earlier as well. It seems that Republicans are a little more confident when you look at President Trump having this summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, which appears to be popular with Republican voters, continued good economic news. So you've observed that enthusiasm as well?
I do. You notice that Republican voters are looking at President Trump as someone who may have scrambled their party's ideology and the leadership, but he's personalized the presidency in a unique way, that it's not so much about the positions of the Republican Party, it's not so much about the ideology, it's about President Trump. And there's some challenges with that, because a lot of lawmakers running for re-election can't really figure out how to run with President Trump. But his strength with his core constituency has enabled him to have this powerful grip on many Republican voters who see his personal fights with the media, with his enemies in the Democratic Party, and his accomplishments on foreign policy and economic policy as things that they take pride in and they want to rally around him in a way that you don't see a lot of Republican base voters often rallying around the establishment or even their own president. There's a lot of skepticism using the Republican base. But now the base has their person in the White House. And so you see with the North Korea summit on the coming, maybe that falls apart, maybe it goes well. This month you have the tax cuts settling in with the economy. You have the trade policies really disrupting international trade policy, then you really see Republican voters sitting up and going, this is different, but maybe we can get behind this. And that's the challenge for the Democrats. The Democrats, to have a blue wave rather than just a blue ripple, they need to make sure that Trump is truly unpopular, that he becomes this lightning rod. If that's not going to be the case, if Republican turnout is going to be strong, Democrats need to really build their own argument between now and November about what's their economic message. Because Trump, he could carry, actually, some of these Republicans in a way that would have seemed almost impossible last summer when it was such chaos in Charlottesville and every day was a Russia controversy in the White House. That seemed like a blue wave was certain. But as I say on my desk at the Washington Post, I have two words: assume nothing. Can't assume anything in politics.
And, you know, people very often over the years, even last summer, heard people saying, oh, this is a one-term president. He won't even survive his 4 years in office. And we're making predictions. And I remember thinking to myself, as someone who's been around for a while myself, is that in politics, things happen quickly and voters don't have long memories a lot of times. So, you know, just think of what's happened between last summer and today. And, you know, you very rarely even hear anything about Charlottesville anymore. So, yeah, there a lot is going on. We're going to talk about some of the things that have gone on in foreign affairs and some other issues with Robert Costa in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Robert Costa. You'll recognize him as moderator of Washington Week on PBS and national political reporter for The Washington Post. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I do want to move to some other issues. What many of us around the world and around the country are watching this morning is the American embassy opening in Jerusalem. The biggest takeaway from the move that was reported by NPR, that is on the scene, and so many others this morning, is that both sides, Israelis as well as, but especially Palestinians, see that the U.S. has chosen sides and comes down squarely on the side of Israel. Your thoughts on this?
That position has real consequences for the prospects of peace negotiations. You see Abbas, the leader of the Palestinians, has now refused to speak to the U.S. for months because of his perception that the U.S. is siding firmly with Israel, and he sees the act of moving the embassy to Jerusalem as a unnecessarily provocative move by the U.S. government. And you see Netanyahu really strengthened by President Trump's positions, not just in moving the embassy to Jerusalem, but you see Netanyahu, who's been facing in Israel allegations of corruption. President Trump removing the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal has also really bolstered Netanyahu inside of Israel. And part of this is because you see in President Trump someone who was committed to Israel throughout the campaign, really rallied supporters of Israel to his cause. And he's had his son-in-law, so there's a family element here, leading the negotiations in the Middle East for him. It's not just been some diplomat or appointee. It's been his own family member. And all those factors, plus the support of evangelical Christians and donors to move the embassy to Jerusalem, you see a coalition inside of this administration to get it done.
You touched on this a bit, but in Washington, is there a general consensus as to whether this move aids or hinders potential peace talks?
It depends on how you view peace talks, in the sense that you could argue it hinders it because the Palestinians so far have been so averse to engaging in peace talks as these kind of moves are made. But if you look at President Trump's position, he always believes, whether it's on trade or foreign policy, that you need to have take a maximum position. Like with North Korea, he called it maximum pressure. Or with the Middle East, to move the embassy to Jerusalem and to withdraw from the Iran deal, to see what other people do when they encounter curveballs in negotiation, or you have to show that you're willing to walk away or you're willing to do something extreme. This is a controversial approach, to negotiations on the world stage. It's something that the president articulated in his book, The Art of the Deal, that came out 30 years ago, but applied to diplomacy and to politics, it's quite different. But that is the way he's moving about this.
You mentioned the Iran nuclear deal. Pulling out of the nuclear deal last week, European allies all opposed that move. How's it being viewed in Washington?
It's being viewed in Washington with some hesitation. Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican, said it was unfortunate the U.S. withdrew from the deal. Chuck Schumer, the Democrat in the Senate, had his own questions about the deal when it first came out in 2015 with President Obama. But you see him thinking that the deal is now in place and it should be kept. It's intriguing because the deal was not popular with all Democrats or all Republicans when it was forged by Secretary of State, then Secretary of State John Kerry, and President Obama and European allies along with the Iranians. But it's become seen as a way in the international community, at least aspects of it, to bring Iran into the global economy, to try to normalize relations with them diplomatically. But there are the concerns that John Bolton, the new national security advisor, and others have is that while it does monitor Iran's nuclear developments and curbs them, there's not much enforcement in their view of Iran's ballistic missiles and Iran's military presence, and they'd like to see more enforcement, more regulations placed on Iran's military because they see Iran encroaching in the Syrian conflict and being a presence there. Israel has been squabbling and skirmishing with Iranian forces in recent weeks, and that kind of factor, beyond just the nuclear aspect of the tight controls in the deal, they'd like to see tighter controls on the ballistic, normal military side, and those could be negotiated in the coming months if there's ever going to be a return to the deal.
What you just described, from the very beginning, even when the deal was reached, as you said, there were Democrats and Republicans who were skeptical that, the comeback from the Obama administration was that, we think that this is the best deal that we can get. And of course, they portrayed it in much more positive terms than that. And I think that this is even what you hear from the European leaders is at least it's better than the no deal at all. You know, it seems as though in today's atmosphere, though, Robert, that we tend to hear the extremes. I mean, after it was announced last week that we were pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, we being the United States, that you heard people predicting that there would be war with Iran. Saw a headline this morning that said that there could be sanctions on some of those European nations that continue with the deal. I don't know. It seems as though, and I want to ask you about the atmosphere in Washington, but it just seems as though we go to those extremes rather than looking at this as, okay, can we do better? Is this the best we can do? That kind of thing.
Well, part of it's the whole approach I was talking about by this Trump administration is that they don't worry about ruffling feathers, and a lot of European allies are alarmed. Macron thought he had a close relationship in France with President Trump. Boris Johnson came over here, the foreign secretary for the UK, to try to convince the administration to stay with the deal, and now to be threatened with sanctions for continuing their own aspect of the Iranian deal. There is alarm in Europe. You see it in some of the headlines, questions about whether the U.S. is operating in good faith. But to me as a reporter, what this comes down to is that President Trump, at the end of the day, wants to have a deal that has his fingerprints all over it, his stamp, and he wants to own the deal on his terms. And he's asserting that the U.S. is not going to be as committed to U.S. International institutions or international agreements, but at the same time, if they are going to do it, it has to really be in President Trump's name and dictated by President Trump. And that's complicated for a lot of these global leaders who just don't think in those terms.
Our guest during this portion of the program today is Robert Costa, who is the moderator of Washington Week on PBS and national political reporter for The Washington Post. If you'd like to weigh in or if you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to say that I'm always curious about what Washington is really like today as we view it from afar. Donald Trump has certainly shaken up Washington, probably hasn't drained the swamp as he promised, but give us a sense of what Washington is like today. Is it as divisive as it appears for the rest of the country?
I've been doing a lot of reading of history recently to try to get a better sense of this. And I really, it's just, hold with me for a second, because I I really think this is kind of the comparison that keeps coming to mind. Is President Trump reminds me, not politically or ideologically, but in terms of that Washington experience question with President Jimmy Carter, who was elected in 1976 as a total outsider, an outsider even within the Democratic Party, comes to Washington in 1977, has total control. The Democratic Party owns Congress, majorities in both chambers, owns the White House. Yet Carter struggles with his own party to get things done. Part of the country really becomes averse to Carter. They're not really positive about his presidency. He feels like he's an isolated figure. You see a lot of comparisons with President Trump in the sense that this is an outsider, never elected to office before, elected to the highest office in the land, President of the United States. His party's in control of Congress, but the whole past year has been about disruption, but it's also been about President Trump in many ways being isolated politically, personally, in a town that functions as a system, as part of the system, or some call it the swamp, and it has a certain way of life here, certain institutions, certain rules, informal, informal. President Trump came in with a big hammer, and he said, to the cheers of some and the chagrin of others, said, I'm going to try to destroy this. And he has succeeded in some parts with his deregulations and in different decisions, but there, that means the town's not going to exactly love you. And you see this in what happened to previous presidents who were outsiders.
You know, that's interesting, because most people probably wouldn't think of Jimmy Carter as a good comparison with Donald Trump, because most of the comparisons have looked at times in American history when a president has come in and there has been a lot of chaos, where he's really shaken up what Washington is like. But, you know, Jimmy Carter is probably the polar opposite of Donald Trump personality-wise. But so that's an interesting, fascinating comparison. We have an email here from John, a listener, who asks, I'd like Mr. Costa to give us some his thoughts on the claim that Trump has basically saved print journalism from irrelevance. And I think he's talking about claims that the president has made.
Well, I hope we were not about to be on the brink of irrelevance as print journalists. I think print journalism is the core of journalism in some respects, because you got to really get the story right, print it, communicate it to the audience, to the reader. I think what the person's question is getting at is that the media and the political media was not really probably drawing the number of readers and viewers before President Trump. And I think that's right, but I don't really credit President Trump, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. But President Trump, in some respects, but it's also the global economy faltering for many people, people's dislocation with the economy, their own lives. I travel around people dealing with personal issues, psychological issues, drug issues. It's a really tough time for a lot of people, and you see people sitting up now across the country paying attention to civic way of life and politics in a way they didn't before. And part of that is because of President Trump being such a character on the American scene and making everyone want to follow it incrementally. And so that has made the narrative of American life something that people do want to follow in print every day. But I do think that there, just after President Obama left, there's been this kind of awakening among people in both parties about sitting up at the edge of their seats and saying, what's going to be next in this country? Who's really going to be in control? Where are we going? The expectations of the Obama era have fallen away. That's not just going to be the guaranteed future. That kind of politics is not going to, as some people assumed, as I say, assume nothing. Some people assume the Obama culture, the Obama era, was going to be the future. And now that's all up for grabs, it seems, in American political life. And I think that has contributed with President Trump to people clicking more and reading more and watching more.
You know, we've talked in the past in this program, and it's been observed many other places, about Americans' interest in civics and getting involved. Do you think that the attention that President Trump has gotten, and just as you described, so many more Americans paying attention, would they be more interested in civics?
I hope so. I think there's a lack of civic education in this country. I know teachers, many of my family members are teachers, work very hard in public and private schools to try to help people learn more about their government. But I think part of it's that we don't have a national culture in the same way we used to. Everyone is in their silos on their phones with their own interests, and that we do need to all, starting with myself, do more to talk about politics and civics and government in a nonpartisan but a vigorous way. People have their views, share your views, debate. But there's kind of this, everyone's in their own echo chamber, but not just in politics, but for music and for sports. And this lack of a national culture is something that's fine. It's nothing we can try to control. It changes life. But at the same time, we really have to pay attention to reminding ourselves that we are part of a country, and that this country has certain democratic institutions that need to be cultivated and preserved, and people have to feel a stake in them. And I'm just a reporter, but I really do value those things, because when you travel around and you meet people who are educated, high school level or college level, and they don't have a grasp of civic knowledge, even though they have certain skills and skill sets, you worry about whether they're as engaged as they need to be. This country needs to have its citizens engaged, not partisan. You can have whatever view you want, but you need to be engaged.
Even though it does appear that more people are engaged, and as you said, it's good that we're having conversations. Many of those conversations aren't very civil sometimes, though, that there appears to be a lot of divisiveness across this country. So how do we have these conversations in ways that are civil, or that we can reach solutions without dividing ourselves even more?
My advice, talk to people in person. There's a lot of this virtue signaling on Facebook and social media, comment sections, people at work silently getting through their day and clicking on an article and writing an anonymous comment on a blog or on some article. That takes you only to a point of engagement. Can you have the courage personally to confront in a pleasant way a family member, a colleague, a neighbor, and just say something about politics or history and just try to have a conversation about something other than something personal or romantic or about food or about the neighborhood? Try to talk about the country, and that's a start, and to get out of your isolation, to get out of your bubble.
When we're talking about the president's relationship with the media, and your newspaper in particular, the Washington Post and the New York Times, what are some of the challenges of covering or reporting on the Trump administration?
There are challenges with every administration. The upside of covering the Trump administration is that many people do talk, sometimes on background, but this is actually quite an accessible administration. The president is probably not as accessible as he should be, could be. He was much more accessible during the campaign, not so much in government. But this administration, because it's full of outsiders, they do want to explain themselves sometimes, and they don't follow the usual Washington rules of kind of being closed mouth about a lot of stuff. Compared to President Obama and the kind of traditional Republicans who follow much more stricter press access sometimes and make it tough. Trump can be turbulent. He'll take shots at the press in a way that is very surreal, and that's fake news and all this. I mean, this is something the press hasn't encountered in a long time, that kind of criticism from the top. But it wakes the press up, too, to make sure you're vigilant with the facts, to make sure you're holding people accountable, but you're also holding yourself accountable, so you make sure the reader understands or the viewer understands that you're operating with total integrity. And that's so critical for our industry, to make sure we maintain our credibility and we don't get rocked by shots from the left or shots from the right.
Robert Costa is the moderator of Washington Week on PBS, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Robert, I'm going to ask you to do something that we're going a little bit backwards here. Usually in Washington Week, you're reviewing the big news stories of the week. I'm going to ask you on a Monday morning, what should we be watching so that we know what you'll be talking about on Friday night?
Well, I got a front page story in today's Post about the Russia investigation. It's 1 year on. 1 year since Mueller was appointed special counsel. What's next? Will the president do an interview or not? Will Rudy Giuliani back away from an interview or not? But the other thing I'm watching is North Korea. Can the president and his advisors set some new parameters for the meeting with Kim Jong-un and make it? Is it going to be about denuclearization wholesale, or could they have a smaller deal in Singapore? And what I mean by that is establish diplomatic ties with North Korea and the Korean War. Could that be part of that meeting? And could that be a success? That's for others to decide. But it's going to be interesting to see how they frame the deal.
I'm curious. I wanted to follow up with what you just described, though. And I don't know if you're – I don't think I'm looking for a personal opinion here as to what you hear. Will the president sit down with Mueller?
At this point, I doubt it. Because too many people I'm talking to, like Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor, say they think the scope is too broad in the investigation and the questions wouldn't be narrow enough for the president to take the time. And they also keep making the argument, the president's legal team to me, that the president's too busy with North Korea and foreign affairs to take the time to really prep for a Mueller interview. But if he doesn't do the interview, Mueller could issue a subpoena, and that could be a drawn-out, protracted legal fight.
How closely is Washington following the Mueller investigation?
Very closely, probably closer than anyone in the country. It's Washington's following the story. I don't hear tons of voters talking about it, though they certainly do pay attention to it, because there hasn't been huge developments other than a few indictments. If someone like Don Jr. or Jared Kushner gets in some kind of legal trouble, maybe it'll stir the story a bit more. But the way I always think about the Mueller investigation is like a submarine, because a few witnesses have described it to me like that. And if you think about a submarine, it's always below the surface. Once in a while, it pops up and it has something to say, but usually it's below the surface and you don't know where it is. That's what most people feel about this investigation.
Robert Costa, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The Mifflin House in Hallam Township, York County, is more than 200 years old and home to one of early Pennsylvania's most prominent families. The Mifflin House also was a stop for escaped slaves on the way to freedom. But the structure could be demolished as part of development. A coalition of historic preservation groups are trying to save Mifflin House, but it may be a mini casino that comes to the rescue. Joining us this morning is historic preservationist Randolph Harris. Mr. Harris, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Great to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Give us a brief history of the Mifflin House.
Kind of difficult to do because it's such a long history. Revolutionary War hero. Served under George Washington, would have been Jonathan Mifflin, born in the mid-18th century, married into the Wright family in, came from Philadelphia, married into the Wright family, which were the pioneer family in Columbia, Lancaster County. And in that cross river section between Wrightsville and Columbia, created a system of underground railroad passageways, transportation networks. They were kind of the bedrock of why Columbia emerged as the centerpiece or as a hub of Underground Railroad activity by the mid-19th century.
Mm-hmm. So, and another name that is, you mentioned Jonathan Mifflin, but mm-hmm. Thomas Mifflin was governor of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and Mifflin County here in Pennsylvania, named yep. for Governor Mifflin. So, I mean, this was a prominent early family mm-hmm. in early Pennsylvania.
Absolutely. Well, this branch of the Mifflin family were distant relatives of Thomas Mifflin. Mm-hmm. They were phenomenal in terms of their role in world trade. Jonathan Mifflin was. He was a seafaring captain. Seemed to have lost some of his commerce activities there in Philadelphia, and that's why he came west to get into the frontier community. But on both sides of the river there was this established early outpost. And what we find is these families were Quaker families. Jonathan Mifflin, even though he served in the military with George Washington, Revolutionary War. We find so many Revolutionary War officers as being at the bedrock of what became this later movement, anti-slavery movement, called the Underground Railroad, because these are the guys that fought on the front lines of all men are created equal, and yet they saw inherent in our society the stain of slavery lingering through this whole early process of our government mm-hmm. and our country.
You know, this is a few things that I'd like to point out. It may be hard for many people to picture this today, that Columbia was the frontier. You know, right along the Susquehanna River was considered the western frontier of the United States at that point, or at least the colonies at that point. And, of course, Wright's Ferry led to Wrightsville and all that. Before we even get into the discussion of the Underground Railroad, that would seem to be significant enough historically that we wouldn't even be talking about not preserving the Mifflin House.
Well, one would think so. One would like to believe that that were the case. But like all historic properties that have this lineage, this physical history that reaches back to our earlier generations, they are not protected. There's a widespread belief, lack of understanding on the part of community in general, that somebody is out there protecting these historic sites through some law, some regulation, some preference given to them because of their historic significance. And that is really not the case. 95% of the decisions about what happens to a physical piece of property, whether it has historic significance or not, is at the local government level, where people have the best opportunity to address and mold the future of their community. What do they want their community to be? In terms of historic buildings, there has been this lack of understanding that people have the same rights through their local governments as do private property owners. The local government has to be the balancing act, the leveler of the playing field, where all sides are heard to make an informed decision about whether a property has so much significance that that community would say, we do not want to have it torn down or altered inappropriately.
What has Helm Township done?
Well, Helm Township, since the, I guess, the 1980s, has had a process in place wherein any particular property on a list in their plan, their comprehensive plan, if it's affected by development, they call in a local group called the Kreitz Creek Valley Preservation Society that I've been volunteering for on and off over the years. Call them in for analysis, look at the property, analyze it to see what kind of historic significance it may have, and advise the township, its planning commission, its board of supervisors. But there is no decision-making process that the board of supervisors has accepted as they are allowed to do under Pennsylvania law. They are allowed to have a system in place that is fair, transparent, gives due process, that allows the township supervisors as the local governing body to say, yes, you can tear this building down or change its character, or no, you can't, because it is so important to our community. And by extension, as we say, all politics are local. Well, all history is local, but it emanates. It can emanate to a statewide level as well as a national level. And that's what the case is we're dealing with the Mifflin House.
All right. So why does, just so we provide background for those who may not be familiar with the situation, why does the Mifflin House, why is it potentially in danger of not being saved?
Well, because the township does not have a process in place that allows all sides to come to the table to make that informed decision, as that municipality is allowed to do under state law. The owners and developers of this property, the Blessing family and the Kinsley Corporation.
Blessing family is the owners,
right
now. Right,
they are the owners. And their co-developer, their development partners, the Kinsley Construction Company, Kinsley Equities. Right up against this, it's in the midst of an industrial park, right off of Route 30 on the west side of the Susquehanna River. So over the years, it's been set aside as on a little bit less than 10 acres, a complete farm complex, and it was a farming, a dairy operation up until 2006. But now development is growing. There's an opportunity, apparently, for some other investment in construction at that site, and the family is willing to sell it, and the developer is willing to put something on that site. So that's been the case. That's been the pressure. That's now being decided in Common Pleas Court in York County, wherein the developer was denied a demolition permit last year because on the plan for this property, it states farm complex to remain. And that notation on that plan has been upheld as valid by the Zoning Hearing Board in Helm Township. The developer contests that. And the groups that I've been working with, Preservation Pennsylvania and with Kreitz Creek Valley Preservation Society, filed a brief in support of that the township's denial of the demolition permit. So that's still being decided in Common Pleas Court.
Mm-hmm. Kinsley, is that the developer you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Kinsley has a reputation of being involved with historic preservation.
Absolutely. No doubt. They've been a stellar record, land conservation, preservation, revitalization of the city of York, where they're based.
Gettysburg.
The Kinsley family, Robert Kinsley, the owner, raised millions and millions of dollars with others to build that amazing Gettysburg Visitor Center, which is a centerpiece and an attraction for the entire country. Yeah, if I could just snap my fingers, I'd love to see the Kinsley family company build an amazing visitor center in and around the Mifflin House. And now we hear about this casino interest in the site, which is brings a whole new wrinkle to the debate and discussion. Can a development of that nature and stature occur without overwhelming the existing historic property? Can it incorporate it into its grounds? I think it that opportunity should be explored by all partners, all people who are interested in the outcome of this situation.
You know, there is some irony here, because I remember when, there were several proposals to locate a casino near Gettysburg. And people like yourself, historic preservationists and those who really saw the battlefield as something that was sacred, fought tooth and nail against that.
Yes.
But in this case, a mini casino could come to the rescue for Mifflin House.
It is ironic when you think about it. Yes, indeed. As I understand it, the site selection has not been made. It might happen in July.
For the casino.
For the casino. Mm-hmm. If site is chosen at Hallam Township, it also includes neighboring Wrightsville Borough. This is right overlooking the Susquehanna River and overlooking across to the east to Columbia. It's the perfect pathway that the Underground Railroad activists were involved in, because these people came from the south across the Mason-Dixon line through all of the counties along the border of southern Pennsylvania, southeastern Pennsylvania. And generally, they couldn't go north because of the Appalachian Ridge, and there was not vast wilderness up there. So they inherently, by grapevine assistance, people moved to the east. And the Columbia-Wrightsville crossing was a point where everybody congregated, both slave catchers as well as people involved in seeking their freedom. So in the Mifflins on one end were the supporting system. Just a beautiful story, the way they've come together in the historic record that we see. The Mifflins and the Wrights engaged an African-American man named Robert Loney as their boatsmen to take people across when slave catchers were covering those crossing points. So we have what we understand to be it's called America's First Civil Rights Movement, basically coming out of the American Revolution around 1800 when the Mifflin House was built. These people got involved, and they moved thousands of people across that river point right there. And that's why the narrative, all the historical records point to that river crossing as one of the earliest places where the Underground Railroad took root, and later was given that name, probably when the actual railroads came through, it was given that name in the 1830s or 1840s.
Where along the river did Robert Loney cross? I'm sure there were probably multiple locations, mm-hmm. but as you said, the slave catchers knew that this was a location where many escaped slaves were congregating as well. So he obviously didn't cross right there between what is now Wrightsville and Columbia. So where along the river was it safe, or was it safer?
Safer, yes. Well, The evidence, like all Underground Railroad narratives, is scant. You find three books that emerged in the late 1800s that tell this story on a kind of a regional and national level. Again, all of them, again, point to Columbia, Wrightsville, and that crossing. The account in Robert Smedley's book, printed in 1883, is where we get the notion of Robert Loney being engaged by the Wrights and the Mifflins. That narrative says he traveled across the river back and forth on the south of Columbia, or just a little bit would have been south of the bridge crossing there, because the water level was higher there. They created an artificial dam to allow the canal boats to go back and forth across the river at the bridge crossing.
As you said, the records are scant sometimes. What proof is there that Mifflin House had a role in the Underground Railroad?
Well, you have to go back to these credible sources that are there. There's a program of the National Park Service called the Network to Freedom that has set a standard for how do you evaluate properties that are considered to have been involved in this basically illegal activity for which was suppressed information back then, and we get filtered information today. You have to produce newspaper articles, books, accounts in books like we just discussed, to understand that. And then you have to identify who the people were. You can look at various records to see what political parties they were involved in, what the years of their births and their deaths, what religious affiliations they had. And you kind of form, you know, you can look at this Underground Railroad story, especially in this area, as like a vast archaeological dig where you pull fragments of pieces together from various sites and various recorded sources, and you come together with a narrative that is based on as credible a sources as you can find. And sometimes by telling the stories continually, then you share that information with more people, and you might find an actual letter or a diary entry that it would be first primary source information that would really solidify that what happened.
Has that happened?
Not in the case. Well, the Mifflins were very prolific writers. There's lots of writings of letters, but of course they wouldn't have written about these activities at that time.
Right. Didn't want anybody to know about it, right?
So oral tradition, family traditions as handed down in this Smedley account, who really did chronicle many of the activities of the abolitionist Quakers who lived in this region. His book is called The Underground Railroad in Chester and Neighboring Counties, but he tells the story of the larger southeastern Pennsylvania region.
You know, I'm thinking back to that time, and it obviously was underground, meaning not literally underground, but that it was something that wasn't publicized. How did escaping slaves find out about this and know where to go?
Well, this is I've had many epiphanies, I guess you could say, rediscoveries of this story as I've gone along. Last March, we went to the new African American Museum of History and Culture in D.C. And there's some amazing displays, amazing graphics that they have there to really tell the story. There were about 6,000 black men in uniform during the American Revolution fighting for the colonial side. There were 22,000 fighting for the British side.
Yeah.
So what that tells me is that for probably the first time, there was migration of people through the military campaigns, north and south, soldiers as well as support facilities. Black men from the South who were never told there was anything but slavery on the plantation saw free blacks in the North when they campaigned to the North, and vice versa. So then traveling itinerant preachers, both African-American and white preachers, we believe that seem to have been involved in this activity of traveling back and forth more or less free and then creating a grapevine of information. That seemed to be, and then follow the North Star. You know, that was the way to, when you had a clear night and you could see the Big Dipper, you could know that north was the way you wanted to go. So all of those things come together, created an impetus. The biggest thing involved was the horrible breaking up of the families of the African-American people who were enslaved. That all the stories that I've researched indicate that when that happened, when that horrible activity, people torn apart and sold off in different directions, that really gave people the impetus to say they can't take this situation anymore, and they left and found out how they could get to where they could go into freedom.
So coming back to today, originally York and Lancaster counties, no municipalities in those counties wanted anything to do with Minnecasino. That has changed. And it appears as though Hellam Township has embraced this now. So mm-hmm. Where does it stand right now with Penn National Gaming is the company that would locate a casino, mini casino, in Hellam Township or Wrightsville in that area. Mm-hmm. So where does it stand right now?
Well, right now is the decision would be made of the three that might be based in York. It looks like York County will get a casino one place or another, and they're three locations that are being considered.
It's like 15-mile radius of Yo, right?
Yes, this being one of them, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be decided, pretty much on the basis of the private company and their plans as they go forward in negotiations that the public's probably not going to understand or see at this point. But it certainly would seem to be that there could be some opportunities where this property could work into a casino plan that would not be detrimental, that would actually be beneficial, that would make this site have a leg up on being an attraction to otherwise people who would not come there.
What has Penn National said about it?
I can only go back to the York Daily Records account of the spokesman who made a statement to the reporter there that they said they're aware of the importance of this Mifflin site as a historic element of the community. And the township has gone on record as asking the gaming company to consider incorporating this building into the development.
We only have about 30 seconds left or so. So what do you want to see happen now? Obviously, you want to see Mifflin House preserved, but what do you think will happen? What do you want to see happen?
Well, I would love to see everybody come together and share ideas, share information, so everybody knows where everybody stands and to see what could possibly become of the future.
Historic preservationist Randolph Harris. Mr. Harris, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll discuss a program that is going to plant 10 million trees. Also author Maya Mao. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.